Welcome to this 11th edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the fifth chapter, titled God and Heaven, Part 2, Heavenly Mother. It should be neither a secret nor a matter of hush-hush blasphemy to the religious believer that our Father in Heaven has a wife who is our Mother in Heaven. Quote, in the heavens are parents single? No, the thought makes reason stare. Truth is reason. Truth eternal tells me I've a mother there. End quote. Goes a segment of the poem, O My Father, by Mormon poetess Eliza Snow. When God created the human race, it went, let us, note the plural, make man in our, plural again, image, after our, plural, likeness. So God created man in his own image, male and female created he them. Note the plurals. Note the two images that resulted, male and female. Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 through 27. Later, as Adam first beholds Eve, God says, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother. Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. Ancient Egyptian theology routinely paired a male and female ruling Godhead in heaven, describing the female half as fusing, joining, wedding herself with another in joyful and salutary combination. Legality itself, the embodiment of every possible social relationship, immune to the slightest hint of scandal, honor, uprightness, and legality personified, truth, justice, and order in the corporate life. She is wisdom. More on this later. Quote, Messages of the Joseph Smith Papyri, Hugh Nibley, pages 252 through 3. Everyone has two mothers, say the Egyptians, one earthly and one heavenly. Previously cited, page 163. In the upper region, the soul has a father and a mother, as the body has a father and a mother in this world. Our Father is the King of Kings. Our Mother is the Queen of the East. Page 493, previously cited. The 45th Psalm, certainly not an Egyptian reference, refers to this King of Heaven, Queen pairing in verse 9. King's daughters were among thy honorable women. Upon thy right hand did stand the queen in gold of Ophir. End quote. As I quoted earlier, Paul uses the phrase family in heaven in Ephesians 3 and 15. Does not a family include a mother? Can one even have a family without a mother? If, then, there is a father-mother pairing in heaven with offspring, is there sex in heaven? The Gospel of Philip in the Nag Hammadi Library, previously cited, page 145, speaks of God begetting sons in heaven. Quote, the heavenly man has many more sons than the earthly man. If the sons of Adam are many, although they die, how much more the sons of the perfect man, they who do not die, but are always begotten. End quote. The dictionary definition of begotten or beget is to become the father of, procreate. In the heavens are parents single? Truly the idea of a heavenly father without a heavenly mother does make reason stare. As to the actual act, I'm not going to go there. I've come up to the front porch of God. I'm not going to peep into his bedroom windows. I'm a firm believer in discretion, letting people have their privacy as long as they're not doing anything illegal. This nosy tell-all day and age drives me nuts. Whatever happened to a proper reticence? Discretion is the better part of valor, has always been resonant with me. As I'll detail shortly, there is no going to the bathroom in heaven. This mortal physical need is taken care of by other means. Perhaps the sects act as we know it in mortality is just a temporary measure to provide mortal bodies for God's spirit children, and spirit children in heaven are conceived by some other process. The Gospel of Philip, chapter 76, verses 6 through 9, goes on to say, "The mating in the next world is of an entirely different nature from this one. Though we use earthly vocabulary in speaking of them, there are other forms of union that transcend all description. I know nothing of the physicality of it, but I'm sure the good elements we experience here, the intimacy, the closeness, tenderness, passion, and love, the personal privacy that makes you as a couple catch each other's eye and smile, and maybe blush, are still part of the experience. A true, mature, and good husband-wife relationship wouldn't be heavenly without these things." Swedenborg does give us some idea of the intimacies between husbands and wives in this realm. Newcomers asked, quote, "If there is the same love between married partners in heaven as on earth?" The angelic spirits answered that it is exactly the same. As to physical pleasures in an intimate relationship, quote, "exactly the same, only much more gratifying, because angelic feeling and touch is much more exquisite than human feeling and touch," end quote. Everyone who comes to heaven returns to the springtime of youth and the potency of that age, and remains like that forever. Previously cited, pages 51 through 52. At this point, perhaps we need to address the proverbial 600-pound gorilla of Christianity that has been in the living room for nearly 2,000 years. Question: did God have sexual intercourse with Mary to produce his child, Jesus? End quote. Let's consider what had to happen, then how it might have happened, to come up with, if not a resolution to this problem, at least a speculative solution that should take it off the table of serious anti-Christian discussion. First, the DNA of God the Father had to combine with the DNA of Mary, the mother-to-be of Jesus Christ. Now, God the Father, being, as I have stated, a glorified, perfected, resurrected human male, would therefore have DNA, I would assume. So why did his DNA have to join with Mary's? Jesus needed to inherit both the characteristics of a mortal mother and an immortal father to accomplish his mission. John chapter 10, verse 18, "No man taketh it, his life, from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again. This commandment have I received of my Father." Those were the powers inherited from both parents. Power over death, which could be inflicted on any other mortal by any person or circumstance, yet the power to die a mortal death of his own free will to accomplish his mission. So how did God's DNA join with Mary's? 200 years ago, there would have been only one known answer: sexual intercourse. They wouldn't have known about DNA, of course, and Mendelian genetics were still half a century away. But now, at the beginning of the 21st century, we can come up with alternatives. Artificial insemination? In vitro fertilization? Perhaps a doctor using a syringe with sperm guided by ultrasound could even fertilize an egg making its way down a fallopian tube and produce a virgin birth. Let us not let a lack of imagination turn us away from one of the important stories of Christianity, and that's just the technology of the 21st century. I mentioned in an earlier chapter how the miracles of Jesus could easily be explained in Star Trek terms. Here, too, we could use Star Trek-nology, which, though not currently available, is theoretically possible. All that has to be done is to beam God's DNA into Mary's ova. Conception is accomplished, and Mary remains a virgin, hymen intact, until Jesus comes through the birth canal. And now we can take our gorilla out of the living room and leave him to make another appearance, in a later chapter. Ancient records, or Apocrypha, concurrent with the records from which our Old and New Testaments were drawn, also confirmed a mother God in heaven working companionably with God our Father. Quote, "He who sitteth upon the great throne, Ptah, Heavenly Father who begot Atum, Heavenly Mother who bore Atum." Nibley, previously cited, Nibley on the Timely and the Timeless, quoting lines from the Shabako Stone, page 25. Nibley also relates recent findings of ancient manuscripts that paint this picture of the heavenly family. The Pearl, and in recently discovered Mandaean manuscripts, the Berlin Cephalia, the Christian comes to earth from his heavenly home, leaving his royal parents behind for a period of testing upon the earth. Then, having overcome the dragon, he returns to the heavenly place, where he is given a rousing welcome. The first person to greet him on his return is his heavenly mother, who was the last one to embrace him as he left to go down to earth. The first embrace is that which the mother of life gave to the first man as he separated himself from her in order to come down to earth to his testing. Old Testament and Related Studies, previously cited, page 91. Paul affirms that in the Lord neither is the man without the woman, neither the woman without the man. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 11. I understand there is a lot of hesitation to bring a mother goddess into the mix. Protestantism revolted against the Mariolatry of the Catholic Church for centuries, and the male and female gods of the Greeks and Romans were in turn repugnant to the Christians of the Roman era. But these long-standing fears and prejudices to the contrary shouldn't keep us from maturing in our spirit attitudes towards a father and mother deity. But why hasn't God included information on our Heavenly Mother in more popular sources such as the Bible? That brings up the matter of respect. Larry Tooley in I Saw Heaven, previously cited, gives this insight. Quote, "He loves and cherishes her, our Heavenly Mother, above all else. He won't allow her name to be had by the mortal children of this creation, so they can't profane her, nor take her name in vain. Father might forgive all else, but this one transgression would never be forgiven. He considers her to be his equal. This is why the earth was patterned after heaven. Man cannot enter the celestial kingdom without the woman, nor the woman without the man. Neither is complete without the other." Page 90, previously cited. The 8th chapter of Proverbs personifies wisdom as feminine and gives her an active role in the creation of the earth. Note the feminine pronouns in verses 1 through 3 and verses 22 through 31 tell how wisdom was with God as he set up our portion of the cosmos and our world. Can we imagine having a good mother and her not taking an active part in so important an endeavor as this? I'm willing to bet she had plenty of input, and our Father listened and reacted accordingly. And the delicate beauties of flowers and some insects and fish, tropical fish, and the rich plumage of many birds. Do we not see a feminine hand here? But think of our Mother in Heaven as the personification of wisdom. A high state indeed for a book that is supposed to be patriarchal to the point of being anti-female. This is also how she is portrayed in a collection of Gnostic Apocrypha too, the Nag Hammadi Library. Quote, "But return, my son, to your first father, God, and wisdom, your mother, from whom you came into being from the very first, in order that you might fight against all your enemies, the powers of the adversary." The Teachings of Sylvanus, Volume 7, page 384. Wisdom is also given the feminine pronoun in the Book of Enoch the Prophet, page 33, volume 42, verses 1 through 2. Quote, "Wisdom found no place where she might dwell. Then a dwelling place was assigned her in the heavens. Wisdom went forth to make her dwelling among the children of men, and found no dwelling place. Wisdom returned to her place and took her seat among the angels. End quote. Wisdom, our Heavenly Mother, came to earth but could find no dwelling place among the children of men. In other words, we rejected her, and she had to retreat to heaven from whence she came. Like willful and rebellious children ignoring their mother's direction, we now have to deal with Dad, who might be a bit tougher and more authoritative with us. The cosmos is no different than our family experiences here on Earth, and the properly functioning earthly family is a good metaphor for what is going on in the eternities. Would that we had been a bit more receptive to Mom or Wisdom. Life might be easier. The British professor Margaret Barker has a YouTube video on Wisdom as our Heavenly Mother. You could look that up if this subject interests you further. Margaret Barker, Wisdom. There are many reasons why God has kept our Eternal Mother in the background. For one, it would cause unnecessary confusion as to whom we should pray and worship. As our children do when they can't get their way with Dad, they'll go behind his back and try and cut a deal with Mom, or vice versa. That won't do in our current situation. We need to keep it simple. One God to pray to, one God to learn about and follow, for now. Denzis Prager, in Think a Second Time, previously cited, devotes a whole chapter as to why God must be depicted as a father and not as a mother. Let me just page through some of his ideas. This, by the way, isn't to say Prager might agree with me on the idea of a mother in heaven. I don't want to put words in his mouth. His main purpose, from what I gather, is to establish reasons for the masculine depiction of God in a time when feminists are offended by the idea. He writes, page 247, quote, "The depiction of God in masculine terms is essential to the Bible's fundamental moral purposes of promoting good behavior, and that the primary perpetrators of evil behavior, such as violence against innocents, are males, especially young males," end quote. He goes on to say that God is neither male nor female. I'd disagree with him on that. Prager continues, page 248, quote, "When males are young, they need to feel accountable to a male authority figure. For this reason, a God depicted in masculine terms, not a mother in heaven, must be the source of such commandments as, thou shalt not murder, and thou shalt not steal." Again, I see the wisdom and reasoning in what he's saying, but I don't think that necessarily makes the case for a sexless, single God. Further, Prager notes, "When the Bible depicts God as merciful, caring for the poor and the widow, and as a lover of justice, it is providing a model for human emulation, especially male emulation. If God were depicted as female, young men would deem traits such as compassion, mercy, and care for the downtrodden as feminine, and in their pursuit of their masculinity, reject them." Previously cited. As for women worshiping a male god, Prager states that girls view their fathers as rule givers and have no trouble identifying with a masculine god. Lastly, he concludes, quote, "It is therefore natural and desirable that God be identified with the gender that is more naturally disposed to rules and justice, males. Females are more naturally inclined toward feelings and compassion, two essential qualities for a decent personal life, but not for the governance of society. A male depiction of God helps make a law-based society possible." Page 249. All of these, I feel, are good reasons for theology's emphasis on a father God, but are not proofs of no mother in heaven. One of the great treats of getting past this moral test will be the family reunion with both father and mother. The poem by Eliza Snow mentioned above concludes, quote, "When I leave this frail existence, when I lay this mortal by, Father, Mother, may I meet you in your royal courts on high." Then at length, when I have completed all you sent me forth to do, with your mutual approbation, let me come and dwell with you. End quote. While we're describing God, let me take a side trip, heads up, more fanciful speculation on the horizon, and deal with the old canard that goes, if God is all-powerful, then he could make a rock so big he couldn't lift it. Well, that's supposed to prove that God is not omnipotent, therefore God does not exist. Well, I used to get around that conundrum by saying, God is also all-wise, so he's smart enough not to get caught in a stupid trap. That still works, but I think I've arrived at a better solution. There is a limit as to how big a rock can be. When it gets big enough, it begins to collapse in on itself because of gravity. Nuclear fusion starts, and it becomes a sun. God can move the sun, as related in Joshua 10, 12 through 14. Since no rock could be larger than the sun, and since God can move the sun, then that old canard can finally be put to rest. The limit is not with God. The limit is with the physical size of rocks. I'm pretty much of the mind now that God didn't actually move the sun, but rather introduced a supergravity source in the path of the sun's light to Earth. The light was bent, giving the appearance of the sun standing still. Joshua, knowing nothing of black holes and their ability to bend light rays, just saw the sun standing still for several hours and assumed that was the reality. The Book of Mormon says of the event, the sun appeared to stand still. Compare Helaman 12:15 in the Book of Mormon with Joshua 10:2-14. Admittedly, the Book of Mormon says the earth moved and not the sun. Personally, I think neither moved, besides the earth's normal rotation and orbit around the sun, but the sun's light was bent by a small supergravity source, black hole, injected into its path for that purpose. Like Joshua, Helaman would have known nothing of black holes and their gravitational effects on light waves. Just speculation. It'll be fun to see how these things all work out. Could God change the rules of the cosmos so rocks could be bigger? Sure. But this isn't a bench press contest. God has bigger fish to fry. If he changed the rules of the universe, then life as we know it couldn't come into being. For God to change the rules just so he could lift a bigger rock and consequently wipe out all organization of matter in the universe, which provides a home for our mortal lives, is a bit much, don't you think? Coming next, will there be mosquitoes in heaven? Yup. Flies, too. I'll deal with that when we get into the details of heaven. Yes, the details of heaven. When it comes to near-death experiences, a glorious afterlife locale has been described. Though descriptions aren't necessarily heaven or the celestial kingdom, our final resting place. We'll call it paradise, as in what Christ promised the repentant thief on the cross next to his, and assume heaven will ultimately be at least as good as paradise, if not better. Luke chapter 23, verse 43. Let's deal with heaven first. We'll worry about hell in the next chapter. No one that I know of had more visionary experience of heaven, or at least paradise, than Emanuel Swedenborg. One aspect he continually stresses in his book, previously cited, is that heaven is more, much more, than sitting on a cloud and playing a harp or eternally praising God. In answer to the question, what is heavenly joy, he gives an answer from an angel. Quote, it is the pleasure of doing something that is of use to oneself and to others, and the pleasure in being useful takes its essence from love and its expression in wisdom. The foundation upon which every use must be built is a sincere desire to be of service to our fellow human beings, because we love the goodness that is in them. Page 23, previously cited. It continues, quote, heaven itself is called a kingdom of uses, and the heartfelt intention to be useful is a necessary prerequisite to becoming an angel. There is no happiness except in an active life. page 24, and every angel is an angel according to usefulness, page 45. An angel sums it up, quote, "You don't know what glorification of God means. It means to bear the fruits of love. That is, to do the work of your occupation faithfully, sincerely, and intently. For this is love of God and love of your neighbor. God is glorified by this, and then by worship at appropriate times." End quote. Page 127, previously cited. So, if one is reserving a harp and a space on a cloud, one might need to think again. One aspect of near-death travels through celestial realms that always gets my attention is the manual labor being performed. From Betty Eady's experience, previously cited, pages 74 through 75, quote, "I saw that they were weaving on large, ancient-looking looms. My first impression was, how archaic, to have manual looms in the spirit world. They were anxious for me to see the workmanship of their hands. The workers were understandably pleased with their work and with my gratitude for being permitted to see it. I was surprised at how much people like to work with their hands there, those who want to. They enjoy creating devices that are helpful to others, both here and there. And we ask ourselves, with all the technology of the 21st century available to us, in paradise they use ancient hand looms and do their work by hand? I think that question misses the point. Those using the looms did so out of enjoyment in service to others and as an expression of their talents and, perhaps, earthly experiences, which talents and experiences are currently denied in our highly automated and impersonal milieu. Besides, when you go to paradise, which would mean more to you? A robe off a factory assembly line put together by robots, or a robe made by your relatives who have gone on before you and put it together for you personally with every thought of love in mind for you? In paradise, it's not like they had to meet production quotas, undercut the competition's prices, and turn in a healthy profit report for the annual shareholders' meeting. One more point. Those doing the manual labor were those who want to and enjoy it. That's the important part. No one is forced to make clothing by hand. Swedenborg, previously cited, says this of heavenly activity, quote, "It is the pleasure of doing something that is of use to oneself and to others, and the pleasure in being useful takes its essence from love and its expression from wisdom. The pleasure in being useful, springing from love through wisdom, is the life and soul of all heavenly joys." Page 23. Will Durant's historian, The Age of Faith, details the industrial side of the Dark Ages. Page 625. He relates how almost all production was done in the home. People baked their own bread and made surpluses to sell. Same with weaving clothing, mending and making shoes and such like. In our modern 21st century, we think, how archaic, how inefficient. Yeah, it probably was compared to our way of doing things, but, and yet this may have been the most wholesome form of industrial organization in history. Its productivity was low. Its degree of contentment was probably relatively high. The worker remained near his family. He determined the hours and, in some measure, the price of his work. His pride and skill gave him character and confidence. He was an artist as well as an artisan, and he had the artist's satisfaction of seeing an integral product taking form under his hands. Previously cited. And now as our 21st century unfolds, we find more people cut off from meaningful work, people laid off because jobs have been outsourced or taken over by robots. Imagine, the economy of heaven is similar to that of the Dark Ages, and is superior to what we've come up with. As for clothing, and for a quick and irrelevant side observation, I note in The Eternal Journey, previously cited, a near-death story relates how, in the spirit world, a man received an article of clothing. "I was dressed in a white garment, tailored like a jumpsuit. The suit covered most of my body, starting with a snug but comfortable neckline. It had full sleeves to my wrists and full legs to my ankles. A curious part of the suit was that it had no openings, such as those we need as humans, end quote. In other words, no fly. Page 181. And now I have to ask the quintessential kid question. How do they go to the bathroom? If in the cosmos we eat and drink, then what happens to the waste product after our body has taken the nourishment from it? My speculation is this. Since it seems all spirits glow and are capable of beyond physical feats of transportation, quantum tunneling, the warping of space, and other things like that, that in the theoretical physics realm would require enormous amounts of energy, perhaps all the energy of the food is used, and there is no waste. I've heard that if all the nuclear energy in the molecules of a raisin were used, that raisin could supply the electrical needs of New York City for a period of 3 days. At the end of 3 days, though, the raisin would be totally used up. Not a molecule would be left over. Numbers aren't accurate, just for illustration's sake. Quantum tunneling and flight beyond the speed of light, or warping of space in Star Trek terms, require huge amounts of energy, at least in current physical Earth terms. Maybe there is no need to go to the bathroom in heaven, because all the energy available in the food heavenly residents eat is used. Don't ask me for proof on this. Don't ask me to go to the blackboard and crunch some numbers. Just speculation, folks. This isn't a hill I want to die on. Speaking of warping of space, as in Star Trek, here's an easy illustration for understanding. Take a piece of paper and draw two random dots on it. Now, what is the shortest distance between those two points? If you've connected them with a straight line, you need to consult with your nearest theoretical physicist. The shortest distance is to fold the paper so one dot touches the other. This illustrates the concept of the warping of the fabric of space. With the use of enormous power and technology a bit beyond what we currently possess, the fabric of space can be folded over on itself, so at one point, hundreds of millions of light-years away, can be brought to within a few miles of another point, and the journey is thus made quickly. Can it be done? Theoretically. That's why warp speed was a charming part of the Star Trek series. Well, this is a lot of unauthorized speculation just from a casual near-death observation of no fly on an article of heavenly clothing. But I did promise such right from the get-go, didn't I? Just as there is a nuts-and-bolts tangibility to God, so there is to paradise. Larry Tooley's observations included these on some benches and other furnishings. Several low benches of white crystallized marble were against one wall. Next to the doorway that entered onto the street was a low bench of a soft pink crystallized marble. Another door, closer in and to the left, was partially opened. The only thing I could see in the room was the corner of a desk and two pictures hanging on the wall. End quote. I saw heaven previously cited, page 59. Are there craftsmen in paradise who make these benches and the pictures that hang on the walls in that office? As the son of an artist, I certainly hope people in paradise aren't buying dime a dozen prints at some big box variety store. I know if that's the case, my dear departed artist father would opt for hell post haste. If people weave clothing on a loom by hand, I see no reason for the other arts and crafts to not also be handmade. Many have been the descriptions of buildings in paradise, but do they get built, as in carpenters and plumbers? Or does God just wave the proverbial magic wand and they spring into place? Again, in the near-death experience of David Kimball, Life Everlasting, previously cited, page 161, we see God letting his children use their talents and gifts rather than having them sit useless and unneeded on the sidelines while he waves his wand. quote, "I was taken in the vision into a vast building, and found myself in a part of the building which was unfinished, though a great many workmen were busy upon it. I felt most at home in the unfinished part among the workmen." End quote. One of the interiors of a building is described as beautiful inside, with mahogany and cherry wood. Another experience in that same book, that of Peter E. Johnson, page 167, tells, "While I was in the spirit world, I observed that the people there were busy, and a continuation of the work we are doing here. There was nothing there that seemed particularly strange to me, everything being natural. As natural as going to a kitchen to prepare a meal. Her mother had told her I must go to the kitchen for a while. Her daughter, visiting on a near-death experience, asked her if she had to work in the kitchen, and she said, of course, I take my turn just like the rest." Page 190. Previously cited. And we extrapolate, food must be prepared. That means spirits eat as we do. Jesus did promise his apostles, "And I appoint unto you a kingdom, that ye may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom." Luke 22:29-30, New Testament. Okay, more fanciful speculation. I have no authority for this whatsoever, but has that stopped me yet? Supposing you long for a meal of prime rib, since no animals are going to be killed for our meals in this place, how do we accomplish this? With advanced sciences in gene splicing and cloning, you could go out into your backyard and pick a prime rib off your prime rib tree. And while you're at it, pick a couple lobster tails off your lobster tail tree and bring them in for a surf and turf feast. No animals are killed. You're eating the fruit off the trees, and you'll be eating just as well as if you'd gone to a $100 a plate buffet in Las Vegas. Or again, going back to Star Trek, perhaps they have one of these matter converters that just converts the extraneous garbage matter into food. I'd rather pick a prime rib off a tree, actually. It has already been mentioned that there is no rest in these realms in terms of lounging around in a recliner all day. There is much to do. Life in the World Unseen, previously quoted, words it thus, page 81, "There is rest in abundance for those who need it, but when the rest has restored them to full vigor and health, the urge to perform some sensible, useful task rises up within them, and opportunities abound. People have been known to become bored, but that very boredom begets their first step in spiritual progression through their engaging in some useful work." Do they celebrate Christmas there? It seems they do. From Life in the Unseen World, previously cited, comes this information. They don't worry about the passage of time there so much as we do on Earth, but for certain events, Christmas being one of them, they observe it to be in sync with us. He doesn't solve whether December 25th is the actually correct date of Christ's birth, but what matters is that the two celebrations, yours and ours, are synchronized and recurrent year by year. End quote, page 91. Christmas is a time when people's thoughts turn to loved ones who have gone on, and those in the spirit world are happy to be remembered and send loving thoughts to us as well. In the particular example of Christmas, we are always visited by great souls from the higher realms, and were all the other means to fail us, this would be an infallible indication of the passing of another year in earthly time. Plato's cave comes to mind again. Here on earth we see but the shadows of the eternal realities. Our institutions, buildings, occupations, and righteous activities are but corrupted, indistinct shadows of the true reality beyond the cave. Continuing with Betty Eady's description of paradise, previously cited, page 78-79, quote, "I saw mountains, spectacular valleys and rivers. The garden was filled with trees and flowers. I walked on grass. It was crisp, cool, and brilliant green, and it felt alive under my feet. A beautiful river ran through the garden. I saw that the river was fed by a large cascading waterfall." I wonder if my son's encounter with grass mentioned earlier was the bringing back of pleasant premortal existence memories. Plants, parks, and the like are mentioned in Lindahl and Widdowson's The Eternal Journey, pages 140 through 146, previously cited. I'm just going to page through this section, which detailed the rural area surrounding the City of Light, which we'll talk about presently. I was in a beautiful landscape. The flowers, trees, the colors were indescribable, not at all like the colors you see here. The sky above me was richly blue, and in it sailed islands of solid white clouds. All around and below me I looked over endless distances, forests, rivers, lakes, ranges upon ranges of hills, mountains to what seemed the very ends of the world. No accounts were found where individuals observed prairies or deserts. In Life in the Unseen World, Benson asks about a sea. Coming from the British Isles, as I have come from Oregon, we would naturally look for a sea to be included in paradise. The answer? Of course there was a seaside, and a very beautiful one too. The view was simply magnificent. Never had I expected to behold such a sea. Its coloring was a most perfect reflection of the blue of the sky above. I could see islands of some considerable size in the distance. There were even large boats, and Benson was informed he could have one if he so desired. Many of the owners lived on them, having no other home but their boat. Previously cited, page 65. As to the beach, the sand upon which we were walking had none of the unpleasant features associated with the seashore of the earth plain. It was never tiring to walk on. It was firm in consistency, although soft to the touch of the hand. Page 65. To continue with the eternal journey previously cited, quote, the landscapes observed consistently were mountains, hills, some of them small green hills, and some tall hills with a rock or two, and valleys. Birds were numerous. All that I observed were of brilliant plumage, and they sang as though their very beings were filled to overflowing with exuberant joy. Also mentioned were cattle, sheep, horses, lions, tigers, beavers, bears, squirrels, deer, and monkeys. I saw Queen Anne's lace being circled by large, graceful butterflies. Animals in paradise shouldn't surprise us. Isaiah, the Old Testament prophet, wrote, "The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together. The cow and the bear shall feed, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox." Isaiah 11, 6-7. I'll have to admit I like Woody Allen's take on this. The lion and the lamb shall lie down together, but the lamb won't get much sleep. Something in the physiology of the predators, at least, will change so they won't need to eat the grazers. This brings us to mosquitoes and flies in heaven, as mentioned above. If the lion can be changed to be happy with straw, then the mosquito can likewise be changed. My guess is that they'll be pollinators. Most are pollinators here in mortality, and only a few, and just the females at that, need blood. Flies and cockroaches will find some non-annoying purpose too, though I'm not sure what. To put this from the abstract into the concrete, we go to the near-death experience of Lance Richardson, The Message, previously cited, pages 100 through 101. Quote, "As I looked upon the beauty, my eyes were suddenly caught by a mighty lion breaking through the bushes into the meadow. He looked directly at me. My immediate reaction was one of fear, and I tensed. The lion began to walk right towards me until he stood exactly by my left side. Suddenly it was as if I heard the lion's spirit communicating to me in my mind. 'It's all right. Don't be afraid. All God's creations are safe in this kingdom.' He winds up petting the lion, all the while being observed by a mother deer with her fawn, walking by calmly and peacefully, just 20 feet away." Lindahl and Widdowson continue, previously cited. One boy, a 3-year-old who had come out of a coma, reported playing with Jesus and some big and little puppies in a garden. Puppies? And does this not imply that animals also come in male and female in paradise and procreate? mother deer and fawn, as per above, too. Another related, my joy was complete when into my arms sprang my little dog, young and full of life. I caressed him and was actually conscious of the smooth, warm softness of his head and coat. Already mentioned is the plethora of educational facilities in the cosmos. From our very beginnings as potential encapsulated into intelligence to the point where we took upon us a spirit life form in the image of God, and from that spirit's education in preparation to coming to mortality to receive a mortal body in that same image, schooling is seemingly part of the kingdom of God as breathing is to mortality. George Ritchie's near-death experience, Return from Tomorrow, pages 69 through 71, describes a paradise university. Quote, enormous buildings stood in a beautiful sunny park. It was more as if all of the schools and colleges in the world were only piecemeal reproductions of this reality. It was more like some tremendous study center, humming with the excitement of great discovery. I glimpsed enormous rooms filled with complex equipment. In several of the rooms, hooded figures bent over intricate charts and diagrams, or sat at the controls of elaborate consoles flickering with lights. We entered a studio where music of a complexity I couldn't begin to follow was being composed and performed. Why, I found myself thinking, Bach is only the beginning. Continuing with Ritchie, previously cited, quote, we walked through a library the size of the whole University of Richmond, with rooms lined floor to ceiling with documents on parchment, clay, leather, metal, and paper. Here, the thought occurred to me, are assembled the important books of the universe. Curiously, in one of the smaller rooms, almost an annex, as Ritchie observes, is contained the central thought of this earth. Now that's the job I want in the cosmos when I graduate here, browsing the bookstores of the cosmos and bringing back samples for this library. I can't help but wonder if becoming human in the cosmos is part of this collection. And whispering in my ear comes the voice of my sarcastic guardian angel, yes, as a doorstop. This is interesting information. Let's see where we can go with this just for the fun of it. One notes first, books from other planets are made of parchment, leather, and paper, among other materials. That means there are animals on other planets whose skins are used for generally the same purposes as the skins of animals on Earth have been used. This augurs well for planets similar to Earth in the cosmos. Paper, too, means plant materials such as trees and papyrus. Also, there is some math here that needs to be done. If the library was the size of the whole University of Richmond and contains the books of all the Earth-like worlds of the cosmos, and a side annex, a smaller room, contains the books of Earth, then we could get a rough estimate of the number of Earth-like worlds in the cosmos where at least writing and the preservation of such in crude form has evolved. It's a simple ratio, as the area of the University of Richmond is to the footprint of a small annex, so is the number of Earth-type inhabited worlds in the cosmos. The University of Richmond covers 350 acres. There are 43,650 square feet in 1 acre. Multiplying that, we get 15,246,000 square feet. Let's assume the annex containing Earth's wisdom literature is 10 by 10, or 100 square feet. Dividing that into Richmond University square feet, we get 152,460 for the number of planets in the cosmos that are Earth-like and have evolved to the point where there is a wisdom literature and a means of preserving it. Let's go with 150,000 for even numbers. Now, let's set that aside for a moment and see how it compares with the Drake equation, a formula put together by SETI researcher, that's Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, Frank Drake, for giving a ballpark estimate of the number of civilizations in our galaxy that have evolved to the point of radio communication and reception. I won't go into the math. For those interested, Lonely Planets by David Grinspoon will give you the information you need on pages 295 through 301. Of course, the Drake equation deals only with our galaxy, and there are billions of those in the cosmos. So anything we come up with need to be multiplied by several billion, assuming God is the God of the whole cosmos, not just our neighborhood. With all their variables and the like, SETI came up with an estimate of from 1,000 on the low side to 100 million on the upper end, give or take a few. Further, these are planets that have presumably evolved to the point of radio broadcast and reception. We've had that capability for only the last 100 years. My 150,000 plus is therefore several orders of magnitude on the low side. Since I'm speaking of the entire cosmos, the Drake equation evolves, it solves only for our galaxy. Bottom line, I've done about 10 minutes worth of work on this. The SETI researchers have devoted months, I'm sure. It always annoys me when some crackpot tries to refute the scientific effort of months or years with a few minutes of armchair speculation, and now I'm the crackpot. But hell, this is just for fun. I'm not writing a proposal on which a NASA budget would be based. Watching a TED the other night on the planets that Hubble and now Kepler are finding, the lecturer said we're finding a lot of Earth-type planets, and the estimate for our galaxy alone now is 100 million. Yep, my numbers are way, way low. That's what I get for underestimating God. Professor Nibley addresses this situation in Old Testament and related studies previously cited. Quote, "There are all kinds of strange beasts on other worlds that we can't even imagine. The Zohar, perhaps the oldest Jewish writing known, says, quote, there are all sorts of creatures for all sorts of environments. Only man is the same everywhere, and yet he's the most individual of all. Man is the only one that is the same everywhere, because he adapts himself in a different way." Another ancient writing quoted by Nibley, the Ginza, says, among 10,000 times 10,000 worlds, you'll find no two alike. That would be 100 million planets, more than my 150,000, and less than the Drake equation. We could take the above to assume maybe not all planets are evolving with human-type life, but I tend to think all planets that can support human life have it, because, as it says, man can adapt to numerous environments, but the animals on these worlds may be different from those here. That's not too far-fetched. Consider the animals of Australia, which evolved separate from the world's other land masses. Kangaroos, platypuses. Even here on Earth, we can see evolution being a when it comes to different life forms. A prayer from the Mandaean prayer book reads, quote, before this world there were already 1,000,000 mysteries and a myriad planets, each with its own mysteries. The multiplicity of worlds, as taught by the early church, formed a perfect unity, as do the strings of a lyre. Each plays a different note. Together they make marvelous harmony. If two strings play the same note, there is not much point to that. Pages 146 through 147. For a long time, I wondered about the phrase, the course of God is one eternal round. I think now that, among other things, it means that the plan of salvation is always going on. Some planets are just starting out, others finishing up, and some, like us, are in the midst of that process. If I understand it correctly, this planet is Christ's project, his doctoral thesis, as it were, for full admission to godhood. We understand he will present this planet in its perfect, saved condition to Heavenly Father for the Father's glory. Christ will then, at that point, be truly, holy, and completely one with God, having shown the universe that he, like the Father, can bring a planet and a population full cycle to complete salvation. I think that's how it works. We're participating in this project, learning how it's done. Are we next? The bottom line, the cosmos is, again, tangible, nuts and bolts. We can barely get a grip on it, at least in terms of numbers that aren't any bigger than our national debt. But from all this, do you see a possible place for you in this expanding cosmos? Even if you're a caterer, the construction crews putting planets together will need lunch breaks. No matter how obscure or esoteric your career path may be, it seems there will be employment for you in these worlds. Swedenborg, previously cited, writes, quote, "There is no happiness except in an active life. It is impossible to enumerate the employments in the heavens, still less to describe them in detail." Page 24. Well, back to paradise. Plant life is touched on in The Eternal Journey, previously cited, pages 144 through 146. Again, just browsing through various selections. Quote, "Everywhere people look, they are deeply impressed with the lush beauty of the spirit world. The grass is greener than anything seen on earth. There are flowers there in magnificent profusion, and trees and shrubs and stretches of greensward. I was not prepared for the sweetest revelation of all, the all-pervading aroma of heaven, the heady perfume. Over our heads was a pergola of vines and Virginia creeper crimson, and wonderful tropical climbers whose delicate orchid blossoms and gorgeous riots of color were mingled with the drooping tassels of wisteria, purple, lemon, and white, and bunches of ripening grapes, nasturtiums, dahlias, tulips, roses, orchids, daisies, violets, Queen Anne lace, lilac, goldenrod. One assumes allergy has been eliminated in paradise. Forget-me-nots, hyacinths, dandelions. Nice to see dandelions elevated above their status as weed. And cowslips. Others noticed very impressive vegetable gardens. Still others saw or found themselves in vast fragrant orchards with trees laden with ripe fruit, which some individuals picked and ate. As to forest trees, there were some beautiful but unfamiliar ones, and also oak, hickory, elms, chestnuts, poplars, birches, and beeches. These are all the surroundings of the center of the cosmos, the city of light, the celestial city, the place where God lives. It's hard from near-death experiences to get a focus on this city. I think many near-death experiencers mistake their immediate surroundings for their ultimate destiny. Only a few report increasingly greater levels of light and glory. The most glorious of all is, of course, the city where God lives, also described as the city of light. As to increasing levels, in the Ascension of Isaiah, an apocryphal text, Isaiah, the Old Testament prophet, is guided by an angel up to the seventh heaven. Each level is more glorious and full of light than the former one. Paul mentions three levels, 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 2. Apparently there are four levels above that. In the near-death experience of a Herr Pettersson, he mistakes his surroundings for heaven. He's straightened out by a spirit guide. Quote, "There were cities and villages, temples and palaces, flowers and animals of great beauty and variety." "I'm afraid that I do not understand you. Are we not in heaven?" "No, brother," the guide replied, "we are not in what mortals call heaven. This is Hades." The Eternal Journey, previously cited, pages 168 through 169. Pettersson was ultimately permitted to visit heaven and its indescribable beauty. And so much for people being tortured and burned in hell forever. We are so small-minded and petty when it comes to the greatness, love, and mercy of God. Swedenborg, previously cited, writes that all spirits who leave this mortality are not walking in heaven, but in the intermediate world where people first come after they have died. It seems that one of the main reasons for the stopping-off point, short of actual heaven, is that we come out of this world loaded with misconceptions as to what heaven is truly like, and this preparation place serves as a reschooling to rid us of our false notions. Spirit prison is another unfortunate connotation. When we hear prison, we picture bars and dark cells with inmates clanging tin cups on the bars. The term prison is used in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 18 through 19, and chapter 4, verse 6 in the New Testament. We mustn't let it throw us off. It is a prison only in the sense that the citizens are being kept there until they find ways to improve themselves, to develop their souls, so they don't make the same mistakes they made in their first time around on earth. Repent, in other words, and prepare themselves to function in the higher realms. It is a prison, no more than elementary school is a prison compared to high school, although in this elementary school, people can be locked in there forever if they refuse to learn and progress. There is no social promotion here. You have to do the work. While there, Swedenborg discovered that heaven also has multiple levels, and inhabitation of each level is contingent on one's diligence on earth and in heaven. Previously quoted, it seems that the assignment to a specific city is conditional on the actions and attitudes of the individual while on earth. The key that opens the gate to a specific city of light is the ability to dwell in the light of that city, and this is evidently dependent on behaviors during earth life. Previously cited, I said many times that it behooves us to try and rise as high as we can, because then we have more options in the cosmos. One of those options is that of visiting lower realms. We can go from higher to lower, but not lower to higher. Travel seems to be relatively free from the higher realms to the lower, but not the reverse. Visits from lower to higher will be permitted, but only with escorts or guides. Reasons for limiting access, both stated and implied, include the protection of individuals from being exposed to environments they could not withstand, to keep people from disrupting the work of those already in the city, to protect sacred areas from people who do not or cannot appreciate them, and to keep people out of areas in which they do not need to be or are not qualified to enter. This is only reasonable. Consider a group of first graders on a field trip to a nuclear reactor. Are they going to be turned loose in the control room to pull levers and push buttons? Not hardly. They are kept under close scrutiny, and appropriately so. And so at the end of a busy day, a couple from the higher realms may go to the lower to enjoy a night out on the cosmos. All the best buffets are in the lower kingdoms of the universe. The sin of gluttony. Okay, sorry, I was leading you on. This does, however, coordinate with what John says at the end of his description of the city of God, as described in Revelations 21, 10 through 27. We'll consider just verse 27. And there shall in no wise enter into it anything that defileth, neither whatsoever worketh abomination or maketh a lie, but they which are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. This description of that city comes from Crowther's Life Everlasting, page 463, previously cited. Quote, the hillside ahead continued its ascent, ending at the base of the mountain. Cliffs rose steeply, disappearing into a hazy mist. At the base of the mountains lay a glorious city. Tall spires and pinnacles rose in exalted splendor, challenging the clouds above for dominance. Light radiated, undulating from the pearlized buildings. 1,000 different shades of color filled the spectrum. Each spire's dome was capped in pure gold. Pinnacles the color of platinum rose among the spires. In this city is God's house. As we have described him as tangible above, it only makes sense that he has a place he calls home. It is described thus, page 465. Quote, my guide pointed to a mansion which excelled everything else in perfection and beauty. It was clothed with fire and intense light. It appeared a fountain of light, throwing brilliant scintillations of glory all around it, and I could conceive of no limit to which these emanations extended. Said my guide, that is where God resides. Some may protest that to put God in a specific geographic location, such as a house, is to limit him, confine him. A radio announcer, limited and confined in a studio, nonetheless has his voice transmitted to whatever receiver can pick him up, depending on the strength of the signal. God's signal is infinitely strong. Having him in a home doesn't limit him. His influence and awareness extend throughout the cosmos. Before we leave, I need to pass on this interesting account of a near-death visit to, I think, not the City of Light, but one of its suburbs, if you will. Quote, I was surprised to see, while many of the homes are spacious, others were very small. Some were barely larger than a small kitchen or a large bathroom. I couldn't imagine why anyone would want to live in a house so small. I asked my brother about this. That was all the material they sent up, was his strange reply. What do you mean? I asked. That was all the good works they sent up, he replied, meaning that the size of a house one gets in paradise is determined on earth by the quantity and quality of the good deeds performed. End quote. This concept is supported by Benson, a spirit guide in the book Life in the World Unseen, previously cited, who relates the people living within these hovels that we were passing were not necessarily those who upon earth had committed some crime in the eyes of the earth people. There were many people who, without doing any harm, had never, never done any good to a single mortal upon earth. People who had lived entirely unto themselves, without a thought for others. Such souls constantly harped upon the theme that they had done no harm to anyone, but they had harmed themselves. Page 60. We pause to note this is paradise, not heaven. Previously cited, page 158. The reason I think this isn't our ultimate goal or destiny is because of the inequality in housing. The City of Light will not be a place of inequality, where the mortal shortcomings of people will be so visibly on display. They would be embarrassed to be there, and we, passing by, assuming our worthiness, would feel embarrassed for them. Many times in the New Testament, Christ warned us to not put our trust in earthly riches, where moth and rust corrupt, but in heavenly treasures. We see this point made tangible in this experience. One hates to leave this paradise, but we must face all the reality of the cosmos. There is an opposite to this, just as there must be an opposite to all things. Just as we have called the above paradise, hesitant to call it our final state, and there is much reason to believe that as fine as these surroundings seem to be, there is greater yet. So we are hesitant to call our next stop hell, for as dark and frightening as this place is, there is worse to come for those who, by their own volition, refuse to escape it. The Catholics, with whom I am certainly no doctrinal expert, have used such words as limbo and purgatory as punishing or preparatory alternatives to hell, and I don't feel they are too far off the mark in this. Spirit prison is not without scriptural authority. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 18 through 19 uses the term, as we've mentioned earlier. In this case, it's inhabited by those who had ignored Noah's warning voice when he was building the ark in preparation for the flood. As Jesus went and preached to them, we must assume that they were being given a second chance at hearing the message of salvation, since they had heard and blown off their first chance with Noah, and since if they were doomed eternally to torment in hell, then there would be no use for Christ to go there and preach to them. So we'll use the term spirit prison and assume that it is a figure of a stopping point short of hell, one where we get a close look, if we're willing to see, of the unhappiness and frustration that is in store for us if we continue to ignore Jesus Christ and the way he has shown us. And thus we conclude this 11th podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled Hell and Evil, and will deal with what is evil. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in. And special thanks to Craig and Kate Whitmore, my technical personnel, without whom this podcast and my website wouldn't even exist in the cloud as dust particles. Visit our website at hazelleproductions.com, hazelleproductions.com. And thank you for tuning in.